Disc 2.
The old man. He'd always been the old man, even during his brief fling with middle age. Where's the old man? Anyone seen the old man? Run for the hills, the old man is coming this way. Now he was an old man, but in Gabriel's mind's eye, he always appeared as the menacing little figure who'd come to see him one afternoon in September 1972, between classes at Bezalel. An iron bar of a man. You could almost hear him clanking as he walked. He had known everything about Gabriel. That he had been raised on an agricultural kibbutz in the Jezreel Valley, and that he had a passionate hatred of farming. That he was something of a lone wolf, even though he was already married at the time to a fellow art student named Leah Savir. That his mother had found the strength to survive Auschwitz, but was no match for the cancer that ravaged her body. That his father had survived Auschwitz too, but was no match for the Egyptian artillery shell that blew him to bits in the Sinai. Shamron knew from Gabriel's military service that he was nearly as good with a gun as he was with a paintbrush.
You watch the news.
I paint.
You know about Munich. You know what happened to our boys there.
Yeah, I heard.
You're not upset by it?
Of course, but I'm not more upset because they're athletes or because it's the Olympics.
You can still be angry.
At who?
At the Palestinians, at the Black September terrorists, who walk around with the blood of your people on their hands.
I never get angry. And though Gabriel did not realize it at the time, those words had sealed Shamron's commitment to him, and the seduction was begun.
You speak languages, yes?
A few.
A few?
My parents didn't like Hebrew, so they spoke the languages from Europe.
Which ones?
You know already. You know all about me. Don't play games with me. And so Shamron decided to play his pickup line. Golda had ordered Shamron to send forth the boys to take down the Black September bastards who had carried out this bloodbath. The operation was to be called Wrath of God. It was not about justice, Shamron had said. It was about taking an eye for an eye. It was about revenge, pure and simple.
Sorry, not interested.
Not interested? Do you know how many boys in this country would give anything to be a part of this team?
Go ask them.
I don't want them. I want you.
Why me?
Because you have gifts, you have languages, you have a clear head. You don't drink and you don't smoke hash. You're not a crazy who's going to go off, half-cocked.
And because you have the emotional coldness of a killer, Shamron thought, although he didn't say these words to Gabriel then. Instead, he told him a story, the story of a young intelligence officer who had been chosen for a special mission because he had a gift. An unusually powerful grip for so small a man. The story of a night in a Buenos Aires suburb when this young intelligence officer had seen a man waiting at a bus stop. Waiting like an ordinary man, Gabriel, an ordinary, pathetic little man. And how this young intelligence officer had leapt from a car and grabbed the man by the throat, and how he had sat on him as the car drove away, and how he had smelled the stink of fear on his breath. The same stink the Jews had emitted as this pathetic little man sent them off to the gas chamber. And the story worked, as Shamron had known it would, because Gabriel was the only son of two Auschwitz survivors, and their scars were his. He was suddenly very tired. Imagine all those years, all those killings, and now he was behind bars for the first time for a murder he did not commit. Thou shalt not get caught, Shamron's 11th commandment. Thou shalt do anything to avoid being arrested. Thou shalt shed the blood of innocence if necessary. No, thought Gabriel, thou shalt not shed innocent blood. He squeezed his eyes shut and tried to sleep, but it was no good. Peterson's incessant light. The lights were surely burning on King Saul Boulevard, too, and a call would go out. Don't wake him, thought Gabriel, because I don't ever want to see his lying face again. Let him sleep. Let the old man sleep. It was a few minutes after 8 a.m. when Peterson entered Gabriel's cell. Gabriel knew this not because Peterson bothered to tell him, but because he managed to glance at the face of Peterson's big diver's watch as Peterson tipped coffee into his mouth. "I've spoken to your chief." He paused to see if his words provoked any response, but Gabriel remained silent. His position was that he was an art restorer, nothing more, and that Herr Peterson was suffering from a case of temporary insanity. "He did me the professional courtesy of not trying to lie his way out of this situation. I appreciate the way he handled things, but it seems Bern has no appetite to pursue this matter further."
"Which matter is that?"
"The matter of your involvement in the murder of Ali Hamidi," Peterson said coldly. Gabriel had the impression he was struggling to control violent thoughts. "Since prosecuting you for your role in the Rolf affair would inevitably reveal your sordid past, we have no choice but to drop charges against you in that matter as well." Peterson clearly disagreed with the decision of his masters in Bern.
"Your government has assured us that you are no longer a member of any branch of Israeli intelligence, and that you did not come to Zurich in any official capacity. My government has chosen to accept these assurances at face value. It has no stomach for allowing Switzerland to become a stage for the Israelis and the Palestinians to relive the horrors of the past."
"When do I get to leave?" "A representative of your government will collect you."
"I'd like to change my clothes. May I have my suitcase?"
"No." Peterson stood up, straightened his tie, and smoothed his hair. Gabriel thought it was an oddly intimate thing for one man to do in front of another. Then he walked to the door, knocked once, and waited for the guard to unlock it.
"I don't like murderers, Mr. Allon, especially when they kill for a government. One of the conditions of your release is that you never set foot in Switzerland again. If you come back here, I'll see to it that you never leave."
The door opened. Peterson started to leave, then turned and faced Gabriel.
"It's a shame about what happened to your wife and son in Vienna. It must be very hard living with a memory like that. I suppose sometimes you wish it had been you in the car instead of them. Good day, Mr. Allen."
It was late afternoon by the time Peterson finally saw fit to release him. Sergeant Major Baer escorted Gabriel from his holding cell, performing this task silently, as though Gabriel was bound for the gallows instead of freedom. Baer surrendered Gabriel's suitcase, his restoration supplies, and a thick, honey-colored envelope containing his personal effects. Gabriel spent a long moment taking careful inventory of his things. Baer looked at his watch as if pressing matters were tugging at him. The clothing in Gabriel's suitcase had been dumped, searched, and stuffed haphazardly back into place. Someone had spilled a flask of Arcosolve in his case. Baer tilted his head. "Sorry, dear man, but these things happen when one bumps up against police officers." Outside, in the misty courtyard, stood a black Mercedes sedan surrounded by a half-dozen uniformed officers. In the windows of the surrounding buildings stood policemen and secretaries come to see the Israeli assassin led away. As Gabriel approached the car, the rear door opened, and a cloud of cigarette smoke billowed forth. A glimpse into the shadowed back seat established the source. He stopped in his tracks, a move that seemed to take Baer completely by surprise. Then, reluctantly, he started walking again, and climbed into the back seat. Baer closed the door, and the car immediately pulled away, the tires slipping over the wet cobblestones. Shamron didn't look at him. Shamron was gazing out the window, his eyes on the next battlefield, his thoughts on the next campaign. Chapter 5. Zurich. To get to Plotten Airport, it was necessary to make the ascent up the Zurichberg one more time. As they breasted the summit, the graceful villas receded, and they entered a river flatland, scarred by ugly modular strip malls. They moved slowly along a clogged two-lane commuter road as the afternoon sun tried to fight its way out of the clouds. A car was following them. The man on the passenger side could have been Peterson. Ari Shamron had come to Zurich in an official capacity, but in dress and manner he had assumed the identity of Herr Heller, the cover he used for his frequent European travels. Herr Rudolf Heller, of Heller Enterprises Limited, an international venture capital firm with offices in London, Paris, Berlin, Bern, and Nassau. His multitude of critics might have said that Heller Enterprises specialized in murder and mayhem, blackmail and betrayal. Heller Enterprises was an old economy firm, the critics said. What Kingsall Boulevard needed to shake off its long winter of despair was a new economy chief for the new economy world. But Herr Heller clung to the keys of the executive suite with one of his patented vice grips, and few in Israel, prime ministers included, could muster the courage to wrest them away from him. To his brotherhood of devoted acolytes, Shamron was a legend. Once Gabriel had been among them. But Shamron was also a liar, an unrepentant, unreconstructed liar. He lied, as a matter of course, lied because he knew no other way. And he had lied to Gabriel time and time again. For a time their relationship had been like that of a father and a son. But the father became like a man who gambles or drinks or sleeps with many women and is forced to lie to his children. And now Gabriel hated him the way only a son can hate his father. "What are you doing here? Why didn't you just send someone from Bern Station to pick me up?"
"Because you're too important to entrust to someone from the station."
Shamron lit another one of his vile Turkish cigarettes and violently snapped the lighter closed.
"Besides, Herr Peterson and his friends from the Foreign Ministry made my appearance here a condition of your release. The Swiss love to yell at me when one of our agents gets in trouble. I'm not sure why. I suppose it reinforces their superiority complex, makes them feel better for their past sins."
"Who's Peterson?"
"Gerhard Peterson works for the Division of Analysis and Protection."
"What the hell is that?"
"The new name for Switzerland's Internal Security Service. It has responsibility for national security matters, counterintelligence, and investigating Swiss citizens suspected of treason. Peterson is the number two man in the division. He oversees all operations."
"How did you convince him to let me go?"
"I played the subservient Jew. I gave them the usual promises that we would not operate on Swiss soil without first consulting Herr Peterson and his superiors in the Swiss Security Service. I also told them about a certain Swiss arms maker who's flogging bomb triggers to terrorists on the open market. I suggested that they see to the situation themselves before someone takes matters into their own hands."
"You always have an ace in the hole."
"It's been my experience that one can never be too prepared."
"I thought your term was over."
"It was supposed to end 6 months ago, but the Prime Minister asked me to stay on. Given the current situation in the territories, we both agreed that now was not the time for a change of leadership at Kingsall Boulevard."
Shamron had probably engineered the uprising himself, thought Gabriel. What better way to make himself indispensable? No, that was beyond even Shamron.
"My offer still stands."
"Which offer is that?"
"Deputy Director for Operations."
"No, thank you." Shamron shrugged.
"Tell me what happened. I want to hear it all from beginning to end."
Gabriel so mistrusted Shamron that he considered giving him an abridged account of the affair, based on the theory that the less Shamron knew about anything, the better. But at least it would give them something new to talk about, instead of refighting old wars. So Gabriel told him everything, starting with his arrival on the overnight train from Paris, and ending with his arrest and interrogation. Shamron looked out the window as Gabriel spoke, turning over his lighter in his fingers.
clockwise, counterclockwise, clockwise, counterclockwise.
Did you see the body?
Very professional, one shot through the eye. He was probably dead before he hit the ground. A coup de grace wasn't necessary.
Did the police ever hit you?
No. Shamron seemed disappointed by this. Gabriel said, Peterson told me the case was dropped because of pressure from Bern.
Perhaps. But there was no way Peterson was ever going to hang the Ali Hamidi job on you. Prosecuting anyone on a 25-year-old murder is hard enough. Prosecuting a professional? He shrugged his shoulders, as if to say such things are just not done. The Hamidi job was a work of art. No witnesses, no evidence.
The movie star handsome face of Ali Abdel Hamidi flashed in Gabriel's memory. Within the corridors of King Saul Boulevard, the amorous Palestinian has been known as the swordsman of Allah. Writer of plays that graced no stage, seducer and manipulator of foolish young women. Would you mind delivering this package to this address for me? You're flying to Tel Aviv? Would you mind taking a package to a friend? The packages would inevitably be filled with explosives, and his lovers would be blown to bits along with anyone else who happened to be nearby. One night in Zurich, Hamidi met a university student named Trude in a bar in the Niederdorf section. When the girl suggested they go back to her flat, Hamidi agreed. 5 minutes later, she led him into the narrow alley, where Gabriel was waiting with a .22-caliber Beretta. Even now, Gabriel could hear the sound of bullets tearing into Hamidi's body.
I suppose I should thank you for getting me out. A show of gratitude isn't necessary. In fact, I'm afraid I owe you an apology.
An apology? Whatever for?
Because if it wasn't for me, you would never have been at Augustus Rolf's villa in the first place.
Rami, Shamron's ever-present personal bodyguard, was behind the wheel of the car. Shamron told him to drive in circles at Klotten. For 20 minutes Gabriel watched the same parade of airline signs and departure gates marching past his window. In his mind he was seeing something else. Flash frames of past operations, old colleagues and old enemies. His palms were damp, his heart was beating faster.
Shamron. He had done it again. Rolf sent a message to us through our embassy, Shamron began. He wanted to meet with someone from the office. He didn't say why, but when a man like Augustus Rolf wants to talk, we usually try to accommodate him. He wanted the meeting to be handled with discretion. I looked into Rolf's background and discovered he was an art collector. Naturally, I thought you were the perfect man for the job, so I arranged for you to be hired to clean one of his paintings. Rubens, if I'm not mistaken.
It was a Raphael. Shamron pulled the face, as if to say such distinctions were of no interest to him. Art, music, literature, the theatre, these things bored him. He was a man of the real world.
Did Isherwood know it was all a game?
Julian. No, I'm afraid I deceived him as well.
Why do it like this? Why didn't you just tell me the truth?
Would you have done it?
No.
A tilt of his bald head, another long pull from his Turkish cigarette.
I rest my case. I'm afraid the truth and I are somewhat estranged. I'm an old man, Gabriel. I've spent my entire life telling lies. To me, lies are more comfortable than the truth.
Let me out of the car. I don't want to hear any more.
Let me finish.
Shut up. I don't want to hear your voice.
Listen to me, Gabriel.
Shamron slammed his fist into the console.
Augustus Rolf, a Swiss banker, wanted to speak to us, and for that he was murdered. I want to know what Rolf was going to tell us, and I want to know who killed him for it.
Find someone else, Ari. Investigating murder cases was never my specialty. Actually, thanks to you, I excelled at quite the other thing.
Please, Gabriel, let's not have this argument again.
You and Peterson seem to be very tight. If you play the subservient Jew again, I'm sure he'd be willing to keep you abreast of all the developments in his investigation.
Augustus Rolf was killed because someone knew you were coming to Zurich. Someone who didn't want you to hear what Augustus Rolf had to say. Someone who was willing to make it appear as though you were the killer.
If that was their intention, they did a damned lousy job of it. I was on the train from Paris at the time Rolf was killed.
Gabriel was calmer now. He was furious with Shamron for deceiving him, but at the same time he was intrigued.
What do you know about Augustus Rolf?
The Rolf family has been stashing money beneath the Bahnhofstrasse for a couple of hundred years. They are one of the most prominent banking families in Switzerland.
Who would want him dead?
A lot of dirty money has flowed through the numbered accounts of Rolf's bank. It's safe to assume he'd made his fair share of enemies.
What else?
The family suffers from a legendary curse. 25 years ago, Rolf's wife committed suicide. She dug her own grave in the garden of Rolf's country chalet, climbed in, and shot herself. A few years after that, Rolf's only son, Maximilian, died in a cycling accident in the Alps.
Is there any family that's alive?
His daughter. At least she was the last time anyone heard from her. Her name is Anna.
His daughter? Is Anna Rolf?
So you know her? I'm impressed. She's only one of the most famous musicians in the world. Do you still want to get out of the car?
Gabriel had been given two gifts that made him a great art restorer. A meticulous attention to detail, and an unflagging desire to see every task, no matter how mundane, through to its conclusion. He never left his studio until his workspace and supplies were spotless, never went to bed with dirty dishes in the sink, and he never left a painting unfinished, even when it was a cover job for Shamron. To Gabriel, a half-restored painting was no longer a work of art, just a bit of oil and pigment smeared on a canvas or wood panel. The dead body of Augustus Rolf, lying at the foot of the Raphael, was like a painting that had only been half-restored. It would not be whole again until Gabriel knew who had killed him and why.
What do you want me to do?
Talk to her.
Why me?
Apparently she has something of an artistic temperament.
From what I've read, that's an understatement.
You're an artist. You speak her language. Perhaps she'll trust you enough to tell you what she knows about her father's affairs. If you come up empty, you can go back to your studio, and I'll never darken your door again.
Promises, promises.
There's no need to be hurtful, Gabriel.
Last time you came into my life, I nearly got myself killed.
True, but at least it wasn't boring.
Peterson says I can't come back to Switzerland. How am I supposed to talk to Anna Rolf?
Apparently, she refuses to live in Switzerland.
Shamron handed him a slip of paper.
This is her management company in London. Give her a few days to bury her father. So you'll do it.
Not for you. I want to know who tried to pin Rolf's murder on me. Who shall I be when I talk to Anna Rolf?
I always prefer the subtle approach, but I leave it to your discretion. Play it as you see fit.
Gabriel slipped the address into his pocket. A thin smile appeared briefly on Shamron's face. He had learned long ago that professional victories, even small ones, were to be savored. The car pulled to the curb beneath a British Airways sign. Gabriel climbed out, collected his things from the trunk, then looked into Shamron's window.
Shamron said, "We didn't discuss your fee." "Don't worry. It will be substantial."
You're on expense account as of now, but remember, throwing money around never solved a case.
I'll consider that pearl of wisdom while I'm flying first class back to London tonight.
Shamron grimaced.
Stay in touch. Usual channels and methods. Do you remember?
How could I ever forget? It was quite an accomplishment, don't you think? What was that? Finding a man 30 minutes after he leaves the scene of a murder. I wonder how Herr Peterson managed to do that. He must be very good.
Chapter 6. Nidwalden, Switzerland. Within the Division of Analysis and Protection, Gerhard Peterson was regarded as a man on the rise. Superiors handled him with care. Subordinates withered under his cold stare. His colleagues looked on in wonder and jealousy. How had the schoolteacher's boy from Erstfeld risen to such heights? Look at him. Never a hair out of place. Never a loose tie. He wears power and success like his expensive aftershave. Peterson never made a move that wasn't calculated to advance his career. His family life was as neat and orderly as his office. His sexual affairs were discreet and appropriate. Anyone foolish enough to stand in his way quickly discovered that Gerhard Peterson was a man with powerful friends. Friends in Bern, friends in the banks. He would be the chief soon, everyone agreed on that. Then a senior posting in the Federal Office for Police. Someday, perhaps, control of the entire Department of Justice and Police. Peterson did have friends in the banks, and they did do favors for him. The Swiss financial oligarchy had been like an invisible hand on his back, nudging him up each rung of the ladder of power. But it was not a one-way street. Peterson did favors for them, too, which is why he was behind the wheel of his Mercedes sedan, racing through the gloomy forest of the Kernwald. At the base of the mountains he came to a road marked Private. He followed the road until he came to an imposing black iron gate. Peterson knew the routine. As he slipped the Mercedes into park and lowered his window, a guard stepped out of a small hut. He had the smooth, precise walk of a man with a military background. Peterson could see the bulge of a weapon beneath his blue ski jacket. Peterson poked his head out the window. "My name is Herr Köhler."
"Are you here for the conference, Herr Köhler?"
"Actually, I'm the entertainment."
"Follow the road to the house. Another man will meet you there."
It was a traditional Swiss chalet in conception, but grotesque in its massive scale. Anchored to the side of the mountain, it stared out across the valley below, with a look of deep satisfaction. Peterson was the last to arrive. The others were already there. They had come from Zurich and Zug, from Lucerne and Bern, and from Geneva and Basel. As was their custom, they had travelled separately and arrived at unevenly spaced intervals, so as not to attract attention. They were all Swiss. Foreigners were not permitted. Foreigners were the reason the group existed. As usual, the meeting would take place in the sprawling, glass-walled living room on the second level of the house. Had any of them bothered to stand in the windows, they would have been treated to a truly remarkable view. A carpet of wet lights on the valley floor, shrouded by a bridal veil of drifting snow. Instead, they huddled together in small groups, smoking, chatting quietly, sipping coffee or tea. Alcoholic beverages were never served at the house. The host, Herr Gessler, drank only tea and mineral water and was a vegetarian. He credited his strict diet for his remarkable longevity. Despite the informal surroundings, Herr Gessler insisted on a boardroom approach to the meetings. The guests did not sit on the comfortable sofas and armchairs, but at a long conference table. At precisely 6 p.m., each man went to his assigned chair and stood behind it. A moment later, a door opened, and a man appeared. Thin and frail, with dark glasses and a gossamer layer of grey hair, he leaned on the arm of a young security man. When he had taken his seat at the head of the table, the others sat down too. There was one empty chair, an unfortunate oversight. After a moment of embarrassed silence, the security guard lifted it by the back and carried it out. In the next room, Gerhard Peterson stared directly into the lens of a video camera, like a talk show guest waiting to appear on a program by remote. It was always this way. Whenever Peterson had business before the council, he spoke to them electronically from a distance. He had never seen Herr Gessler or any of the other men in the room, at least not in connection with the council. Herr Gessler said the peculiar arrangement was for their protection, and perhaps more importantly, his.
Gerhard, are you ready?
It was the reedy voice of Herr Gessler, made even thinner by the tiny earpiece.
Yes, I'm ready. I hope we haven't taken you away from any pressing state business, Gerhard?
Not at all, Herr Gessler. Just an interdepartmental meeting on drug trafficking.
Such a waste of time, this silly war on narcotics.
Gessler was infamous for his sudden digressions. Peterson folded his hands and bided his time.
Personally, I've never seen the attraction of drugs, but then I've never seen the harm, either. What someone puts in their body is none of my business. If they wish to destroy their life and their health with these chemicals, why should I care? Why should governments care? Why should governments spend untold resources combating a problem that is as old as human nature itself? After all, one could argue that Adam was the first substance abuser. God forbid young Adam's a fruit, and he consumed it the first chance he got.
You make an interesting point, Herr Gessler.
Our detractors say that the drug trade has been very good to Switzerland. I'm afraid I would have to concur. I'm certain my own bank contains accounts of the so-called drug kingpins. But what is the harm? At least if the money is deposited in Switzerland, it is put to good use. It is loaned to legitimate enterprises that produce goods and services and employment for millions of people.
So they can go out and buy more drugs?
If that's what they wish. You see, there is a circular quality to life on Earth. Nature is in harmony. So is the global financial system. But just as nature can be thrown out of balance by a seemingly small occurrence, so can business. Imagine the destructive consequences if the profits of the drug trade were not recirculated back into the world economy. The bankers of Switzerland are performing a valuable service.
Gessler sipped his tea. Peterson could not see this, but could hear it in the sensitive microphone used to amplify the old man's weak voice.
But I digress,
Gessler said, as his teacup rattled back into the saucer.
Back to the business at hand. It seems we have another complication concerning the Rolf matter.
Does this fellow strike you as the kind of man who will let the matter drop?
Gessler said when Peterson was finished with his briefing.
No, Herr Gessler.
Then what do you suggest?
That we clean up the mess as quickly as possible and make certain there's nothing for him to find.
Gessler sighed.
It was never the purpose of this body to engage in violence, only to combat the violence that is being done to us.
In war, there are casualties.
Surveillance and intimidation is one thing. Killing is quite another. It's critical we use someone who can't be linked to the council in any way. Surely in your other line of work you've come across people like this.
I have.
The old man sighed. Gerhard Peterson pulled out the earpiece and headed back to Zurich. Chapter 7. Corsica. There was an old joke on Corsica that the island's notoriously treacherous roads had been designed jointly by Machiavelli and the Marquis de Sade. Yet the Englishman had never minded driving there. Indeed, he tore around the island with a certain fatalistic abandon that had earned him the reputation of being something of a madman. At the moment, he was racing along a windswept highway on the western edge of the island, through a thick blanket of marine fog. 5 miles on, he turned inland. As he climbed into the hills, the fog gave way to a clear blue afternoon sky. The autumn sunlight brought out the contrasting shades of green in the olive trees and Lauritio pine. In the shadow of the trees were dense patches of gorse and briar and rock rose, the legendary Corsican undergrowth known as the Macchia, that had concealed bandits and murderers for centuries. The Englishman lowered his window. The warm scent of rosemary washed over his face. Ahead of him stood a hill town, a cluster of sand-colored houses with red tile roofs, huddled around a bell tower, half in shadow, half in brilliant sunlight. In the background rose the mountains, ice-blue snow on the highest peaks. 10 years ago, when he had first settled here, the children would point at him with their index fingers and pinkies, the Corsican way of warding off the evil eye of a stranger. Now they smiled and waved as he sped through the town and headed up the cul-de-sac valley toward his villa. Along the way he passed a paisano, working a small patch of vegetables at the roadside. The man peered at the Englishman, black eyes smoldering beneath the brim of his broad hat, and signaled his recognition with an almost imperceptible wave of his first two fingers. The old paisano was one of the Englishman's adopted clansmen. Farther up the road, a young boy called Giancomo stepped into his path and waved his arms for the Englishman to stop.
"Welcome home. Was your trip good?"
"Very good."
"What did you bring me?"
"That depends."
"On what?"
"On whether you watched my villa for me while I was away."
"Of course I did, just as I promised."
"Did anyone come?"
"No, I saw no one."
"You're quite sure?" The boy nodded. From his suitcase, the Englishman removed a beautiful satchel, handmade of fine Spanish leather, and handed it to the boy. "For your books, so you won't lose them on the way home from school any more." The boy pulled the satchel to his nose and smelled the new leather. Then he said,
"Do you have any cigarettes?"
"You won't tell your mother?"
"Of course not."
The men pretended to rule Corsica, but the real power lay in the hands of the mothers. The Englishman handed the boy a half-empty packet. He slipped the cigarettes into his satchel.
"One more thing."
"What's that?"
"Don Orsatti wishes to speak with you."
"When did you see him?"
"This morning."
"Where?"
"At the café in the village."
"Where is he now?"
"At the café in the village."
"Orsatti lives a stressful life," thought the Englishman. "Invite the Don to my villa for lunch, but tell him that if he expects to eat, he should bring along some food." The boy smiled and scampered off, the leather satchel flailing behind him like a banner. The Englishman slipped the jeep into gear and continued up the road. About a half mile from his villa, he slammed on his brakes, and the jeep skidded to a stop amid a cloud of red dust. Standing in the center of the narrow track was a large male goat. He had the markings of a palomino and a red beard. Like the Englishman, he was scarred from old battles. The goat detested the Englishman and blocked the road to his villa whenever it pleased him. The Englishman had dreamed many times of ending the conflict once and for all with the Glock pistol he kept in his glove box. But the beast belonged to Don Casabianca, and if he were ever harmed, there would be a feud. The Englishman honked his horn. Don Casabianca's goat threw back his head and glared at him defiantly. The Englishman had two choices, both unpleasant. He could wait out the goat, or he could try to move him. He took a long look over his shoulder to make sure no one was watching. Then he threw open his door and charged the goat, waving his hands and screaming like a lunatic, until the beast gave ground and darted into the shelter of the Macchia. A fitting place for him, thought the Englishman. The Macchia, the place where all thieves and bandits eventually reside. He got back into his jeep and headed up the road to his villa, thinking about the terrible shame of it. A highly accomplished assassin, yet he couldn't get to his own home without first suffering a humiliation at the hands of Don Casabianca's wretched goat. It had never taken much to spark a feud on Corsica. An insult, an accusation of cheating in the marketplace, dissolution of an engagement, the pregnancy of an unmarried woman. Once, in the Englishman's village, there had been a 40-year feud over the keys to the church. After the initial spark, unrest quickly followed. An ox would be killed, The owner of the ox would retaliate by killing a mule or a flock of sheep. A prized olive tree would be chopped down, a fence toppled, a house would burn. Then the murders would start, and on it would go, sometimes for a generation or more, until the aggrieved parties had settled their differences or given up the fight in exhaustion. On Corsica, most men were all too willing to do their killing themselves, but there were always some who needed others to do the blood work for them. Notables who were too squeamish to get their hands dirty or unwilling to risk arrest or exile. Women who could not kill for themselves or had no male kin to do the deed on their behalf. People like these relied on professionals, the Tadunagyu. Usually they turned to the Osati clan. The Osatis had fine land with many olive trees, and their oil was regarded as the sweetest in all of Corsica. But they did more than produce fine olive oil. No one knew how many Corsicans had died at the hands of Osati assassins over the ages, least of all the Osatis themselves, but local law placed the number in the thousands. It might have been significantly higher, if not for the clan's rigorous vetting process. In the old days, the Osatis operated by a strict code. They refused to carry out a killing unless satisfied that the party before them had indeed been wronged, and blood vengeance was required. Anton Osati had taken over the helm of the family business in troubled times. The French authorities had managed to eradicate feuding and the vendetta in all but the most isolated pockets of the island. Few Corsicans required the services of the Tadunagyu any longer. But Anton Osati was a shrewd businessman. He knew he could either fold his tent and become a mere producer of excellent olive oil, or expand his base of operations and look for opportunities elsewhere. He decided on the second course and took his business across the water. Now his band of assassins was regarded as the most reliable and professional in Europe. They roamed the continent, killing on behalf of wealthy men, criminals, insurance cheats, and sometimes even governments. Most of the men they killed deserved to die, but competition and the exigencies of the modern age had required Anton Osati to forsake the old code of his ancestors. Every job offer that crossed his desk was accepted, no matter how distasteful, as long as it did not place the life of one of his assassins in unreasonable danger. Osati always found it slightly amusing that his most skilled employee was not a Corsican, but an Englishman from Highgate in North London. Only Osati knew the truth about him, that he had served in the famed Special Air Service, that he had killed men in Northern Ireland and Iraq, that his former masters believed him to be dead. Once the Englishman showed Osati a clipping from a London newspaper, his obituary. A very useful thing in this line of work, thought Osati. People don't often look for a dead man. He may have been born an Englishman, but Osati always thought he had been given the restless soul of a Corsican. He spoke the dialect as well as Osati, mistrusted outsiders, and despised all authority. At night, he would sit in the village square with the old men, scowling at the boys on their skateboards, and grumbling about how the young had no respect for the old ways. He was a man of honor, sometimes too much honor, for Osati's taste. Still, he was a superb assassin, the finest Osati had ever known. He had been trained by the most efficient killers on the planet, and Osati had learned much from him. He was also perfectly suited to certain assignments on the continent, which is why Anton Osati came calling on the Englishman's villa that afternoon with an armful of groceries. Osati was a descendant of a family of notables, but in dress and appetite he was not much different from the paisano working his patch down the valley road. He wore a bleached white shirt unbuttoned to the center of his barrel chest and dusty leather sandals. The lunch that he brought with him consisted of a loaf of coarse bread, a flask of olive oil, a chunk of aromatic Corsican ham, and a lump of strong cheese. The Englishman provided the wine. The afternoon was warm, so they ate outside on the terrace overlooking the cul-de-sac valley, in the dappled shade of a pair of towering Corsican pines.
Orsatti handed the Englishman a check bearing the imprint of Orsatti Olive Oil. All of Orsatti's assassins were officially employees of the company. The Englishman was a vice president for marketing, whatever that meant.
Your share of the fee for the Spain assignment.
Orsatti swirled a piece of the bread in oil and shoved it into his mouth.
Any problems?
The girl was working for the Spanish Security Service.
Which girl?
The girl Navarra was seeing.
Oh, shit. What did you do?
She saw my face. Orsatti contemplated this news while he sawed off a slice of the ham and placed it on the Englishman's plate. Neither man liked collateral casualties. They were usually bad for business. How are you feeling?
I'm tired. Still not sleeping well.
Not while I'm in a foreign country killing a man.
And here?
Better. You should try to get some rest tonight instead of sitting up all hours with the old ones in the village.
Why?
Because I have another job for you.
I just finished a job. Give it to one of the others.
It's too sensitive.
You have a dossier?
Orsatti finished his lunch and swam lazy laps in the pool while the Englishman read. When he finished, he looked up.
What has this man done to deserve to die?
Apparently, he stole something quite valuable. The Englishman closed the file. He had no compunction about killing someone who stole for a living. In the Englishman's opinion, a thief was Earth's lowest life form.
So why does this job require me?
Because the contractors would like the target dead and his business destroyed. The men who trained you at Hereford taught you how to use explosives. My men are comfortable with more conventional weapons.
Where am I going to get a bomb?
Orsatti climbed out of the pool and vigorously toweled his thick silver hair.
Do you know Pascal Debray?
Unfortunately, the Englishman did know Pascal Debray. He was an arsonist who did jobs for a Marseille-based criminal enterprise. Debray would have to be handled carefully.
Debray knows to expect you. He'll give you whatever you need for the job.
When do I leave? Chapter 8. Costa da Prata, Portugal. By all appearances, the woman who had settled in the refurbished old monastery on the steep hill overlooking the sea had taken a vow to live the sequestered existence of an ascetic. For a long time, no one in the village knew even her name. Señora Rosa, the scandalmonger checkout clerk at the market, decided she was a woman scorned, and she inflicted her dubious theory on anyone unfortunate enough to pass by her register. It was Rosa who christened the woman Our Lady of the Hillside. The moniker clung to her, even after her real name became known. She came to the village each morning to do her marketing, sweeping down the hill on her bright red motor scooter, her blonde ponytail flying behind her like a banner. In wet weather she wore a hooded anorak the color of mushrooms. There was a great deal of speculation about her country of origin. Her limited Portuguese was heavily accented. Carlos, the man who cared for the villa's grounds and small vineyard, thought she had the accent of a German and the dark soul of a Viennese Jew. Maria, the pious woman who cleaned her home, decided she was Dutch. José, from the fish market, thought Danish. But Manuel, the owner of the café on the village square and the town's unofficial mayor, settled the question as he usually did.
Our lady is not German or Austrian or Dutch or Danish.
Then he rubbed his first two fingers against his thumb, the international symbol for money.
Our Lady of the Hillside is Swiss.
Her days had a predictable rhythm. After her morning visit to the village, she could be seen swimming laps in her dark blue pool, her hair tucked beneath a black rubber cap. Then she would walk, usually among the jagged granite outcroppings on the ridge of the hill, or up the dusty track to the Moorish ruins. Beginning in the late afternoon, she would play the violin, exceptionally well, according to those who had heard her, in a bare room on the second floor of the villa. Once Maria stole a glance inside and found Our Lady in a feverish state,
her body rocking and pitching about, her hair damp, her eyes tightly closed.
"Our lady plays like she's possessed by demons," Maria said to Carlos, "and no sheet music, she plays from memory."
Only once during the festival of Santo Antonio did she take part in the social life of the village. Shortly after dark, as the men set fire to the charcoal grills and uncorked the wine, she traipsed down the hill in a sleeveless white dress and sandals. For the first time, she was not alone. There were 14 in all: an Italian opera singer, a French fashion model, a British film actor, a German painter, along with wives, girlfriends, mistresses, and lovers. The opera singer and the film actor had a contest to see who could consume the most grilled sardines, the traditional fare of the festival. The opera singer easily dispatched the actor, who then tried to console himself by making a clumsy pass at the fashion model. The actor's wife slapped him silly in the center of the square. The Portuguese villagers, who had never seen a woman slapping a man, applauded wildly, and the dancing resumed. Afterward, all agreed that the band of gypsies from the villa on the hillside had made the festival the most enjoyable in memory. Only Our Lady seemed to take no joy from it. To Carlos, she seemed an island of melancholia in a sea of wild debauchery. She picked at her food, she drank her wine as though it was something that was expected of her. When the handsome German painter planted himself at her side and showered her with attention, Our Lady was polite but clearly indifferent. The painter finally gave up and went in search of other prey. At midnight, just as the festival reached fever pitch, Our Lady slipped away from the party and headed up the track alone to her villa on the hillside. 20 minutes later, Carlos saw a light flare briefly in the room on the second floor. It was the room where Our Lady played her violin. With little else to do that summer, the villagers set out to finally learn the name and occupation of the mysterious woman from the hillside. Carlos and Maria, the two people closest to her, were carefully interrogated, but could offer little help. Once a month, they received a check, sent by certified mail, from a company in London called European Artistic Management. Because of the barriers of language and class, their communication with the woman was restricted to the simplest of greetings. They were able to supply one piece of critical information. Our Lady was prone to sudden, unexplained absences. Rosa of the Market read much into this. She decided Our Lady was a spy, and that European Artistic Management was nothing but a front. What else would explain her secretive nature? Her sudden disappearances, and even more sudden returns. But once again it was Manuel who settled this question. One evening, while the debate raged in his café, he reached beneath the bar and produced a compact disc recording of several Brahms violin sonatas. On the cover was a photograph of Our Lady.
"Her name is Anna Rolf," Manuel said in triumph. "Our Lady of the Hillside is a very famous woman."
She was also a woman prone to accidents. There was the afternoon she lost control of her motor scooter, and Carlos found her by the roadside with a pair of broken ribs. A month later, she slipped on the edge of the pool and cracked her head. Just 2 weeks after that, she lost her balance at the top of the stairs and tumbled down to the landing, coming to rest in Maria's dustpan. Carlos concluded that for some reason, Our Lady simply lacked the ability to look after herself. She was not a reckless woman, just careless, and she seemed to learn nothing from her previous mistakes.
"It will be very bad for the reputation of the village if something happened to so famous a woman," Manuel concluded gravely. "She needs to be protected from herself."
And so quietly, carefully, Carlos began to watch her. In the mornings, when she swam laps in her pool, he would find work to do close by so he could monitor her progress. He conducted regular clandestine inspections of her motor scooter to make certain it was in good working order. In the tiny hamlets along the top of the ridge, he created a network of watchers, so that whenever Our Lady went for her afternoon expeditions, she was under constant surveillance. His diligence paid off. It was Carlos who discovered that Our Lady was hiking on the ridge the afternoon a powerful gale swept in from the sea.
He found her amid the wreckage of a rock slide, with her hand pinned beneath a 100-pound boulder, and carried her unconscious down to the village. Had it not been for Carlos, the doctors in Lisbon said, Anna Rolf would surely have lost her famous left hand. Her rehabilitation was long and painful for everyone. For several weeks, her left arm was immobilized by a heavy fiberglass cast. Since she was no longer able to ride her motor scooter, Carlos was pressed into service as her driver. Each morning they climbed into her white Land Rover and rattled down the hill into the village. Our Lady remained silent during these trips, staring out the window, her bandaged hand in her lap. Once Carlos tried to brighten her mood with Mozart. She removed the disc and hurled it into the passing trees. Carlos never again made the mistake of trying to play music for her. The bandages became progressively smaller until finally she required none at all. The severe swelling receded and the shape of her hand returned to normal. Only the scars remained. Our Lady did her best to conceal them. She wore long-sleeved blouses with lacy cuffs. As she moved round the village doing her marketing, she tucked her hand beneath her right arm. Her mood darkened further when she tried to play the violin again. Each afternoon for 5 consecutive days, she walked up to her practice room on the second floor of the villa. Each day she would attempt something elementary, a minor scale over 2 octaves, an arpeggio. But even that would be too much for her ruined hand. Before long there would be a scream of anguish followed by shouting in German. On the 5th day, Carlos watched from the vineyard as Our Lady lifted her priceless Guarneri violin over her head and prepared to hurl it to the floor. Instead, she lowered it to her breast and hugged it as she wept. That evening in the café, Carlos told Manuel about the scene he had witnessed. Manuel reached for the telephone and asked the operator for the number of a company called European Artistic Management in London. 48 hours later, a small delegation arrived. There was an Englishwoman named Fiona, an American called Gregory, and a dour German called Herr Lang. Each morning Gregory forced Our Lady to do several hours of punishing exercises to regain the strength and mobility in her hands. In the afternoon Herr Lang stood over her in her practice room, teaching her how to play her instrument again. Slowly her skills returned, though even Carlos the vineyard keeper could tell that she was not the same musician she had been before the accident. By October the delegation was gone, and Our Lady was alone again. Her days assumed the predictable rhythm they'd had before the accident, though she took more care when riding her red motor scooter, and never set out for the ridge without first checking the weather forecast. Then, on All Souls' Day, she vanished. Carlos took note of the fact that as she climbed into her Range Rover and headed toward Lisbon, she carried only a black leather garment bag and no violin. The next day he went to the café and told Manuel what he had seen. Manuel showed him a story in the International Herald Tribune. The vineyard keeper could not read English, so Manuel handled the translation.
"The death of a father is a terrible thing," Carlos said, "but murder, this is much worse."
"Indeed," said Manuel, folding the newspaper, "but you should hear what happened to that poor woman's mother."
Carlos was working in the vineyard, preparing the vines for the onset of winter, when Our Lady returned from Zurich. She paused briefly in the drive to unclasp her hair and shake it loose in the sea wind, then disappeared into the villa. A moment later, Carlos saw her flash past the window of her practice room. No lights. Our Lady always practiced in the dark. As she began to play, Carlos lowered his head and resumed his work, his pruning shears snapping rhythmically, keeping time with the beating of the waves on the beach below. It was a piece she had played often, a mystical, haunting sonata, supposedly inspired by the devil himself, but since the accident it had eluded her. He braced himself for the inevitable explosion, but after 5 minutes his shears fell silent, and he looked up the terraced hillside toward the villa. So skillful was her playing tonight that it seemed there were 2 violinists in the villa instead of 1. The air had turned colder, and a gauzy sea haze was creeping up the slope of the hill. Carlos set his pile of rubbish alight and squatted next to the flames.
She was approaching a difficult section of the piece, a treacherous run of descending notes. A devilish passage, he thought, smiling. Once again he braced himself, but tonight only music exploded, a blistering descent that ended in the quiet resolution of the first movement. She paused a few seconds, then began the second movement. Carlos turned and looked up the hillside. The villa was bathed in the orange light of sunset. Maria, the housekeeper, was outside on the terrace, sweeping. Carlos removed his hat and held it aloft, waiting for Maria to see him. Shouting or noise of any kind was forbidden while Our Lady was practicing. After a moment, Maria lifted her head, and her broom paused in mid-stroke. Carlos held out his hands. "What do you think, Maria? Will it be all right this time?" The housekeeper pressed her palms together and gazed up toward the heavens. "Thank you, God." "Indeed," thought Carlos, as he watched the smoke of his fire dancing on the evening wind. "Thank you, God. Tonight things are good. The weather is fine, the vineyards are ready for winter, and Our Lady of the Hillside is playing her sonata again." 4 hours later, Anna Rolf lowered her violin and placed it in its case. Immediately she was overcome by the unique combination of exhaustion and restlessness she felt at the end of every practice session. She walked into her bedroom and lay atop the cool duvet, her arms spread wide, listening to the sound of her own breathing and to the night wind rustling in the eaves. She felt something else besides fatigue and restlessness, something she had not felt in a very long time. She supposed it was satisfaction. The Tartini Sonata had always been her signature piece, but since the accident the wicked string crossings and demanding double stops had been too much for her hand. Tonight she had played it exceptionally well for the first time since her recovery. She had always found that her mood was reflected in her playing. Anger, sadness, anxiety, all these emotions revealed themselves when she placed the bow against the strings of a violin. She wondered why the emotions unleashed by the death of her father would allow her to again play Tartini's sonata. Suddenly she required activity. She sat upright, pulled off her damp T-shirt, and slipped into a cotton sweater. For several minutes she wandered aimlessly through the rooms of her villa, here switching on a lamp, here closing a shutter. The smooth terracotta floors were cold against her bare feet. How she loved this place, with its whitewashed walls and comfortable sailcloth-covered furniture. It was so unlike the house on the Zürich Berg, where she was raised. The rooms were big and open, instead of small and dark, the furnishings unpretentious and simple. This was an honest house, a house with no secrets. It was her house. In the kitchen she poured herself a large glass of red wine. It was from a local vintner. Indeed, some of her own grapes had been used in the blend. After a moment the wine took the edge off her mood. It was a dirty little secret of the classical music world, the drinking. She had worked with orchestras that had come back from lunch breaks so medicated with alcohol it was a wonder anyone could play at all. She peered into the refrigerator. She had hardly eaten in Zurich and was famished. She sautéed mushrooms and tomatoes in olive oil and fresh local herbs, then stirred in 3 beaten eggs and added some grated cheese. After the nightmare of Zurich, this simple domestic task gave her an inordinate amount of pleasure. When the omelette was finished, she sat on a tall stool at the kitchen counter and ate it with the last of her wine. It was then she noticed the light winking on her answering machine. There were 4 messages. Long ago she had switched off all the ringers on the telephones to avoid being disturbed while she was practicing. She forked a bite of the omelette into her mouth and pressed the play button on the machine. The first message was from her father's lawyer in Zurich. It seemed he had some more papers for her to sign. Would it be convenient to send them by overnight parcel to the villa? Yes, it would be, she thought. She'd telephone him in the morning. The second call was Marco. A long time ago they had been engaged to be married. Like Anna, Marco was a gifted soloist, but he was little known outside Italy. He could never get over the fact that Anna was a star and he was not, and he had punished her by sleeping with half the women in Rome. After Marco, she had taken a vow to never again fall in love with a musician. "I read about your father in the papers, Anna, darling. I'm so sorry, my love. What can I do?
Do you need anything from me? I'll get on the next plane.
No, you won't, she thought. She'd call Marco in the morning, after she finished with the lawyer. With a bit of luck, she'd get his machine and be spared the indignity of having to hear his voice in real time. The third message was from Fiona Richardson. Fiona was the only person in the world Anna trusted completely. Each time she had stumbled, Fiona had been there to pull her back onto her feet.
Are you home yet, Anna? How was the funeral? Perfectly awful, I'm sure. They always are. I've been thinking about Venice. Perhaps we should postpone it. Zakaria will understand, and so will your fans. No one can be expected to perform so soon after something like this. You need time to grieve, Anna, even if you did despise the old bastard. Call me.
She would not be postponing her recital in Venice. She was surprised Fiona would even suggest it. She had cancelled 2 coming-out appearances already. There had been rumblings in the press and among orchestra masters and concert promoters. If she cancelled a 3rd, the damage could be irreparable. She'd call Fiona in the morning and tell her she was going to Venice in 2 weeks. The final message. Fiona again.
One more thing, Anna. A very nice gentleman from the Israeli embassy stopped by the office 2 days ago. Said he wanted to contact you. Said he had information about your father's death. He seemed perfectly harmless. You might want to hear what he has to say. He left a number. Have a pen?
This book is continued on Disc 3.